As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Audible, presented by Trader Joe's. I'm Stuart Mandel, joined as always by Bruce Feldman. It is Thanksgiving week. It is rivalry week. Bruce, before we get to that, why don't we take a little bit of a rewind to the weekend? We both were out covering games this week.
So you were at the big game in Columbus this weekend. Impressions of your whole trip there and what you take away from getting your first glimpse at the Buckeyes in person.
It's always good to be back in Columbus. I think over the course of my career, I've probably covered more games at the Horseshoe than anywhere else, but not as many recently. Great atmosphere there. The weather cooperated. It actually, the forecast was for there to be a downpour at some point, and it finally happened after the game when we were back up in the press box writing, so I appreciated that. I think that my biggest takeaway, I mean, first of all, yes, it was their closest game to this point. In fact, it was even a four-point game at one point, even into early in the fourth quarter. And I never felt like Penn State was going to win. Ohio State was dominant.
Not even when the game got narrowed after back-to-back turnovers and the momentum had shifted?
No. I thought that, okay, they just turned it. They just shot themselves in the foot as much as a team possibly can. The back-to-back J.K. Dobbins fumble at his own 12. And then the Justin Fields fumble. Now, there was a moment there where Penn State did have a chance to go in there and tie the game. And a third down sack by Chase Young and Jayshon Cornell cut them to a field goal. And I think at that point I thought, okay, well, they needed that, obviously. And I think I was sitting next to our Ohio State writer, Ari Wasserman, and at that point, it was 21-17, and he said, you know this is going to end up 35-17, right? And I thought it would. It ended up 28-17. You know, I think that it was cool to see Justin Fields do his thing in person, but really, it's all about Chase Young to me. This is my first time seeing him in person, and he didn't disappoint, right, after two-game suspension. He's credited with three sacks. A couple of those were him and another guy. So really he was in on four or five sacks. He had nine tackles. He just, more I think than most any defensive lineman I've seen, he just makes his presence felt on every play, very much like Ndamukong Suh a decade ago. So, you know, this thought that emerged after the Wisconsin game of him as a Heisman candidate that you thought was probably done after missing two games. We put up our Heisman straw poll on The Athletic Monday. He's number two. It's Burrow by a considerable margin, mind you. Chase Young, Justin Fields. I don't think he can win it, but I think it's starting to look like we may see him in New York.
Well, I think we're going to see him in New York. Here's why I don't think he will win it. Look, Joe Burrow's had a remarkable season. This isn't like a year where you haven't had a clear top guy who's had a great run. He's been great in big games. as long as he keeps rolling at this pace, I think he's going to win it. What I think will keep Chase Young from not getting that close to, I think he's going to be second, but what I think will hurt him is one of two things. One, he was suspended for two games, and that's not only two games where he probably could have added another six sacks and who knows how many TFLs, but I think there will be a chunk of voters. And maybe they're not the kind of voters who are in our athletic straw poll, which you have, quite honestly, are people who are a lot more engaged in the sport than what, you know, 1,000 people who vote for the Heisman. A lot of those people are not that engaged in college football, and that's a story for another day. But I think there's a chunk of them who will say, well, this guy was suspended for two games. I'm taking him off my ballot. And I think that if you're a defensive lineman and you're trying to win the Heisman, not saying he's trying to win the Heisman, but I think people will hold that against you, and that will undercut, because you won't even get any votes if they're not on the ballot. It's not, you know, it's one of those deals where if you're not first, second, or third, that stuff adds up. And I think that's probably what will happen to his candidacy to some extent. But to the bigger point of this,
you think that there are voters who, like a considerable number, not just a few, that are so offended by NCAA rules violations that they're
going to, I think they're just going to say, well, he's suspended for two games. Yes, I do think there are those people out there.
I think it's different than like when Peter Warwick shoplifted and that cost him a chance at the Heisman.
Some of those people are still Heisman voters, Stu. They usually don't take Heisman
votes away.
No, but
I'm saying I think they differentiate between a guy got suspended for, you know, doing something something you get arrested for versus, as is reported, you know, took a loan that he shouldn't have taken to send his girlfriend to the Rose Bowl.
I'm just saying, whether it's 20 people or 60 people, I think there are going to be a chunk of people who will not put him on their ballot because they said he's suspended for two games.
Okay.
Maybe I'm wrong, but that's how I feel. That's kind of my read on the 1,000 or so Heisman voters. There is a chunk of those people who will just say, it'll give them an excuse not to put him on their ballot.
I do think it's too early to say, oh, he's definitely going to finish second or even definitely get invited. But he does have, I mean, the crazy thing is that he's there now. He's that high now. And his next two games are going to be games that everybody's watching against Michigan and in the Big Ten Championship game. If he has big games in those, I mean, I guess there is that scenario possibly where he has, first of all, he's already at 16 and a half sacks. I look back, 5 of the last 8 years, that would have been enough to finish the season number one in the country in sacks. And we're talking about through 9 games. You know, if he gets 2 sacks in each of the next 2 games, and you're talking about 20, that's a very rare number.
You know, so what I else? Guess, what I think also works against him, Stu, which is on College Game Day on Saturday morning, Kirk Herbstreit was really talking about J.K. Dobbins a lot. J.K. Dobbins had a really good game. I mean, I had 35 carries for 150 yards, something like that. But I think, and we're talking about Justin Fields. Realistically, that is going to, I can't remember a time in a while. Like, I remember when it was Ken Dorsey and Willis McGahee. I remember certainly when it was Reggie and Leinart. But you just don't, that comes from the same place, right? So that's not going to help, that the fact that you have two other guys who are candidates. And if Ohio State beats Michigan, which I think they probably will, but if they will, I'm guessing one of those offensive guys is probably going to have a big game too. And I think you will have people who will say that. And look, if you were to ask me in the first hour of that broadcast, it was Justin Fields who was converting big third down plays and was a difference for them. So again, I think that's, I didn't want to go all the way in on this Heisman discussion, which I feel like we have maybe, and that's my fault, but you know, that's just kind of how my read on it at this point.
I think Justin Fields will be in New York. I think that's probably more certain than Chase Young, but it doesn't mean that, I mean, in our ballot right now, it's both. It's Young number two, Fields number three. You're right. We have listeners who get turned off at the mere mention of the Heisman, so we should probably turn the page on that one. What are your thoughts right now on the topic that I wrote about from that game where the number one seed is going to be important this year for a couple of reasons, but the main one being that if you agree that Ohio State, LSU, and Clemson are clearly ahead and a level or two above everybody else, then obviously you'd want to get that one seed and play somebody other than those three.
Yeah,
and I think it could be down to the wire of Ohio State or LSU.
I've made that point recently as well. I think what you're going to see is, and we're going to get into Georgia in a minute, but what kind of push is LSU going to get if they do in fact beat Georgia for the SEC title? I think it may come down to who's more impressive in who gets to 13-0 than anything else. But I agree. Right now, when you look at the polls just that came out on Sunday, there's a pretty big gap between the two. It's not like it's like 40 first place votes for LSU and like 29. I mean, LSU, Ohio State has single digits now. Now, I think they would get more winning on the road in Ann Arbor than certainly than LSU would get for beating an A&M team that would become a 7-5 A&M team. But then when you start talking about Georgia in the Georgia Dome versus, or it's not Georgia Dome anymore, right? It's the
Mercedes-Benz.
Sorry. Yeah, I think it could swing back the other way. So we're getting ahead of ourselves, though.
Yeah, I think LSU beating both Alabama and Georgia would probably be the difference. I think,
especially when neither one of those games would be a home game for them.
It's pretty good much point. Enemy Ohio territory. State, maybe by the end of if they beat, I don't know if it'll be Wisconsin or Minnesota yet in the championship game, but chances are the highest ranked team they will have beaten at the end of the year will be in the low top 10. So, it's a question of resume, and we'll have plenty of time to debate that over the next couple of weeks. Or just the fact that Ohio State is excelling on both sides of the ball, whereas LSU is very much about its offense, not so much its defense.
By the way, interesting point. I've noticed something just to finish that up. So Nick Saban is playing Auburn this week. It's obviously the huge rivalry game. And this is what he said at his Monday press conference about Auburn. This is the best team we played probably so far this year. He's already lost to LSU at home.
That's a very interesting comment. It makes you wonder if either he, A, temporarily forgot about the LSU game, B, very much remembers the LSU game and truly thinks Auburn is either more talented or I don't know what, or C, just wanted to get a little zinger in at LSU.
Yeah. I don't know.
It doesn't speak well for Gus if he truly believes that, if they're truly the best team. Then why are they only 8-3?
Well, look, their defensive line is big time. Their defense is good. I think their offense is nowhere near where we are talking about with Joe Burrow and company.
Yeah, he might be. I mean, he might be thinking primarily about that Auburn defense and having to go against that Auburn defense with Mac Jones.
All right, Stu, let's talk some Georgia football.
Yes, in particular, I'm already looking ahead to that LSU-Georgia game. So if you watched Saturday, Georgia-Texas A&M, Georgia pretty much controlled the game. A&M got back in it towards the end. They end up winning 19-13. Georgia is the number 4 team in the country, and I think that's totally deserved. Obviously, they have a good resume. Yes, they had a terrible loss to South Carolina, but they've beaten Florida, Notre Dame, Auburn, all of them top 15 teams. And I'm still having a hard time seeing them beating LSU. Where are you on this?
You know, they can really run the football, and Jake Fromm has played in a lot of big games, and they have a really good defense. I think they have a chance. I mean, they have a decent chance. They're a good team. Question is going to be, can they really slow down this offense significantly? And look, I think we're jumping the gun, I feel like, by going in that direction. I think, there'll be time to talk about that matchup.
It's going to be a really, really big game, and it's set. My thing with Georgia is, yes, they have a fantastic defense. In fact, Texas A&M, literally the week before, had two 100-yard rushers. Against Georgia, as a team, they ran 20 times for -1 yard. That's how good that Georgia defense is. But something's not right with Jake Fromm. He's not playing anywhere near the level that he was last season or maybe even as a freshman. the last couple weeks.
His receivers aren't as good as they were, though.
His receivers are not as good, for sure. I mean, it's – now, I guess what it comes down to is the way Georgia is winning is the way a lot of teams have won the SEC and even national championships. They are basically a – you know, we know Kirby is a Nick Saban protege, and Georgia is pretty much like a spitting image of the way Alabama used to win games, you know, circa 2009, 2010, et cetera. The question is, in 2019, can you beat a team with an offense as lethal as LSU's playing that style of football? Like, even if they do, you know, even if Joe Burrow doesn't have nearly the kind of game he usually does because Georgia's defense is so good, I still think they're going to have to score points. I don't think it's going to be 20-13. Georgia's last six games, starting with that overtime loss to South Carolina, they lost that game 20-17. Then they beat Kentucky 21-0, Florida 24-17, Missouri 27-0, Auburn 21-14, Texas A&M 19-13. So we're talking about a top four team that has not scored 30 points in a game since October 5th. You know how rare that is in 2019?
You gonna tell me factually how rare it is, or?
No, I don't. Rhetorical. I don't have any facts
okay.
to give you.
Okay, sorry.
It's just so jarring to see everybody scores 30 points or more consistently these days. So, Bill Connolly, S&P, well now it's SP Plus, efficiency guru, had a tweet on the morning that we're recording this, you know, showing just how dominant Georgia's defense was against A&M, and saying, this UGA defense is increasingly terrifying. So is the UGA offense, but in a completely different way. The 09-13 Alabama comparisons write themselves at this point. To which I replied, did those 2009-13 Alabama teams ever play or beat an offense on the level of this 2019 LSU team? I think the only ones we could really think of were the Johnny Manziel A&M teams, maybe the last Tebow Florida team that they beat in the SEC title game. But then Jim Hobart, a Twitter follower, pointed out that in 2011, Alabama averaged 34 points a game in conference. In 2012, they averaged 38 points a game in conference. Georgia is averaging 25. It's going to be fascinating. It's going to be new age Joe Brady, Joe Burrow offense versus old school Kirby Smart defense. Back to the podcast in a minute, but guys, are you planning to spend rivalry weekend in your sweatpants watching college football, but might be sick of Thanksgiving leftovers? Enter DoorDash, restaurant quality food with a living room dress code. DoorDash connects you to your favorite restaurants in your city. Ordering is easy. Open the DoorDash app, choose what you want to eat, and your food will be delivered to you wherever you are. Not only is your favorite pizza joint already on DoorDash, but there are over 340,000 restaurants in 3,300 cities, so you might find a new favorite too. I personally use DoorDash on most college football Saturday nights when I'm home watching games. And right now, our listeners can get $5 off their first order of $15 or more when you download the DoorDash app and enter promo code Audible. That's $5 off your first order when you download the DoorDash app from the App Store and enter promo code Audible. Don't forget, that's promo code Audible for $5 off your first order from DoorDash. Now back to the podcast. Okay, so you're at Oklahoma TCU, and on Saturday night, I get back to the hotel, and we've got Oregon on the ropes, you know, big upset that's going to shake up the playoff race, and pretty focused on that. And then you're seeing, well, wait a minute, Oklahoma TCU is getting back in the game against Oklahoma. I better turn over to that. And one of the first things I see is Jalen Hurts throw a brutal pick six near the goal line that gets returned 98 yards for a touchdown. He also has a fumble that helps TCU get back in the game. And then at the end of the game, in one of the weirder officiating moments I've seen, Oklahoma was able to seal the game because they picked up a first down that quite clearly wasn't a first down. Tell me what was going on there.
Which place? You want to start with Jalen, or you want to start with the officiating call?
Why don't you start real quick with the officiating call, and then we'll get into Jalen.
Yeah, it's curious. I think it's really hard. You know, so first of all, I'm on the sideline. My angle is not good at that from where I'm standing. It's not like I can stand in midfield. But I'm listening to our broadcast, and I heard what Brock Ewart and Joe Davis said, and then Dean Blandino, who's our officiating expert. I think the hardest part of that was, okay, where exactly is the official going to spot this on what looks like a judgment call? And I think a lot of people, not just TCU fans, were like incredulous at how they arrived at the decision they did. And Gary Patterson is one of them, who was just like, that just is, was puzzling. And I really thought, standing on the Oklahoma sideline, the defense was ready to go in. I think a lot of people over there were expecting them to be sending the defense out on the field, and the Big 12 officials did not see it that way for some reason. And I don't know. I mean,
and then the replay couldn't overturn it because it's just a big mass of bodies. And
yeah, that's right. That's know. That was a point Dean was making. So, one of the more curious calls, and I think the viewers at home saw it with their own eyes. We're just kind of like a little puzzled.
Well, this is what leads to, I'm not generally a believer in officiating conspiracy theories, but when it's the team that is the conference's best hope to make the playoff getting a very generous spot to avoid an upset, this is why people get suspicious of conference officiating. In terms of Jalen Hurts, I wrote about this in Forward Pass. You look at his stats on the season, they're phenomenal. They're actually even better than Baker Mayfield and Kyler Murray. And that's just the passing. He's also ran for well over 1,000 yards. And yet, if you've watched the last two Oklahoma games, he has single-handedly almost cost them the game with his turnovers. Three of them against Baylor when they dug that big hole, and the two that allowed TCU to get back in the game. I'm feeling very conflicted about him and the Sooners right now because they keep winning. And if they beat Oklahoma State this week, who's ranked, and Baylor again in the Big 12 title game, who's top 12 or so, that's going to end up being a pretty good resume. And yet, it's hard to have that much confidence in them right now because they keep escaping every week, and their quarterback's not playing as well as he was earlier in the year.
Yeah, and you even didn't mention the Iowa State game. So in the first half of that, he throws what Matt Campbell said should have been two pick sixes. They both get dropped. So they... it's been shaky. Look, there was a bunch of plays where he overshoots a receiver or throws behind him. He was not very sharp as a passer. Now, he's a fantastic running quarterback, but some of the stuff that the NFL folks were a little skeptical on with him back in Alabama, talking to some NFL scouts this week or this past week, they're still skeptical of. And that's really, he holds the ball too long and doesn't anticipate like they would like to see a quarterback do, especially if they're going to look at him as an NFL quarterback prospect. They ran it a lot. I mean, they ran it like percentage-wise like the old school Barry Switzer teams ran it, and they ran it really effectively. But I'm with you to some extent on what you said, that they have, the passing efficiency numbers have really dipped with Jalen in this offense, and I think that I still think they'll probably, we have them this week again in Bedlam on Saturday, and it's supposed to be a really rainy, messy day. But, their defense stepped up when they needed to step up. And actually, except for a really long run by Max Duggan, I thought their defense played pretty well. So it's just a lack of consistency with them. They've played four roller coaster crazy games in a row. The furthest out was when the one they lost, where they got in a deep hole against K-State and rallied to make it interesting. Then we had them where they had the huge lead against Iowa State at home, up 21, and then they almost lost. Then obviously the Baylor game, and then this past weekend when it got, again, it was felt very similar to the Iowa State game, where it looked like they were going to blow TCU out of the building, and then all of a sudden it got really tight. And this is a hard team to get a great read on. I do think they're better on defense than they've been in the years past, but the offense isn't quite what it was back certainly a year ago, or when they had all that confidence in Baker, and I felt like they were just a little more dangerous.
So, I mean, after the Oregon loss, it sure looks like that fourth spot is going to come down to Utah if it wins the Pac-12 title game, which is obviously not a guarantee. Alabama, if it wins the Iron Bowl, also not a guarantee. And then, you know, what I'm trying to get at is there's a path opening up here where Oklahoma, if it wins out, would be the, if not the clear fourth choice, you know, right up there in the mix. And yet, I don't have much confidence in them. I don't have much confidence in them, and yet they're going to play an Oklahoma State team this week that's missing its quarterback and its star receiver and had trouble, you know, doing much on offense against West Virginia. And then they're going to rematch against Baylor, who they've already beaten once. So it's almost like they would get in for lack of better options.
So let me ask you two. I want to ask you a question, and then I'm going to come back with a follow-up. The first one is, I've seen Utah in person a couple of times. I've seen Oklahoma in person now three times. I feel like Utah has been the more impressive team. I feel like I know what they're getting with their defense, and they're very physical on offense with a good quarterback and a terrific running back in Zach Moss. I have a little more confidence in them. If you ask me who I think, again, now we need to see these games play out. Maybe Oklahoma will blow those teams away and Utah will really sputter. But right now, I think Utah looks like the team that would get that fourth spot. Am I wrong?
They're definitely the clubhouse leader. I think if they do beat Colorado this week and beat Oregon, who they really could have used Oregon being 11-1, so it'd be a real signature win. But even if Oregon's 10-2, that's a good win. And you know, barring a Georgia upset of LSU, that would then, you know, bounce everybody else. You know, I think they're the clubhouse leader, but I think it's going to get contentious for several reasons. My strong hunch is that not many people east of the Rockies have watched Utah this season. You know, their games are, first of all, they're not a big brand name team, and second of all, their games are not usually in the big viewing windows. Now, this week's is ABC is actually putting Utah Colorado in prime time, but Colorado is 5-6, and I don't know if that's going to be considered appointment viewing. And then we can talk about how great they look. I agree. I think that this is a team that plays fantastic defense. Their quarterback's extremely efficient. Zach Moss is a stud. This is a really good team. And yet, if somebody says, who have they beaten? Can't argue with that. Is it six and five? Washington is maybe their best win? Or BYU out of conference? The Pac-12 has just eaten its own this year to the point where after Washington's pretty bad loss to Colorado this week, Utah, because they lost to USC, who's 8-4, they have not beaten anybody that's better than 6-5 right now on their conference schedule. So the Alabama hasn't played anybody argument kind of applies to Utah as well.
Yeah, so I think what we'll be looking at is a conference championship and a win over a 10-3 Oregon team.
Which I think would be the difference against Alabama. Okay. I know there are people who are going to, up till the very last minute, say, I'll believe it when I see it, that the committee would pick Utah over Alabama. And, of course, we haven't yet seen what Alabama looks like without Tua against a good opponent. But if, as is written in that Founding Fathers document, if two teams are comparable or close or whatever the exact wording is, the conference champion is supposed to be a tiebreaker, then you know, they're going to be one spot apart this week, I assume, when the committee rankings come out. If you're one spot apart and one team goes to a conference championship game and beats a 10-win team and the other one sits home, that would seem to be the definition of a tiebreaker.
Okay. Let me ask you this that popped into my head. It's actually on our car ride back from the stadium late Saturday night, which is this. What would the committee do if Oregon ends up beating Utah in the Pac-12 title game and Baylor ends up beating Oklahoma in the rematch? Baylor would be a 12-1 team with beating the only team that had beaten them. Would Baylor get in over Alabama, do you think?
I do not. And maybe that's not right. I don't know. But the committee has been very down on Baylor for a couple of reasons.
Yeah, but the committee hasn't seen Baylor beat anybody yet.
So Baylor has wins over top 25 teams, right? And obviously the Oklahoma game was right down to the wire. but they've just had one escape after another until actually this Texas game that we're going to talk about in a minute, where they beat them handily. But they also, I mean, I think it's at least two, if not three straight Rob Mullins teleconferences. He has made a point of bringing up that Baylor's three non-conference opponents have a combined 7 wins. They're very down on Baylor. And so do you really think, and they're going to play Kansas this week. So do you really think that that win over Oklahoma in the Big 12 title game, a team who they've already lost to, is going to be enough to convince the committee that, yeah, forget everything we said before, we now think they're one of the four best teams in the country?
I don't know, Stu. Here's the problem with it. You're talking about a team that would be a conference champ, that would have a really good win. Beating Oklahoma will be better than any win Alabama has. Better than any win Alabama has. Also, I think if you want to talk eyeball test, I think you have to recalibrate your eyeball on Alabama with Mac Jones as opposed to Tua. Now, they could beat Auburn 44-7, and maybe they will, and maybe that'll change what I'm thinking. But this is really the only window we're going to have to seeing what is the Alabama team. Not the Tua team, this team. And so I think for people looking at it going, well, they're just going to default Alabama in, you're going to have to factor a ton on the resume, and the resume is not going to be strong. So then you're going to have to factor it in on the eyeball test. And the eyeball test is basically one game, because their defense hasn't been that good, Tua or not, has not been anything special. And now Tua's not the guy. So you're going to give them a ton of stock on a team that would win a game against an 8-4 Auburn team. Right?
It is. It's a fascinating situation that we haven't really dealt with before. You know, I've seen all these in the last week or so, all these tweets about Alabama will be favored by this much against this team.
That's stupid. That's a stupid point to bring up.
But the point is, it's based on data that is kind of irrelevant now. It's based on
season to date
with a phenomenal quarterback. You know, that's not the team that's going to play against Auburn this week, and that would be playing in the playoff. So I think, you know, just looking back at last week's committee rankings. Okay, as of last week, Alabama was number 5, Baylor was number 14. So we're talking about a 9-spot difference they have to close. I think the only way Baylor is getting in the playoff is if Utah, Alabama, and Oklahoma, well, they would take care of Oklahoma. I think they need Alabama to lose the Iron Bowl, and then they need Oregon, two-loss Oregon, to be the Pac-12 champ. And then I think they could do it, which is kind of crazy to think of Baylor. You know, I mean, they've had a great season. I still don't think many people are taking them that seriously, but they're close enough now. They're close enough to, it's very attainable at this point, 12-1 conference championship, that you know, we've always said, if you're a 12-1 Power 5 champ, it's going to be very hard for you to be left out. Ohio State got left out last year as a 12-1 Power 5 champ. In part because there was an undefeated.
They got blown off the field at Purdue, though.
Yes. But also, Notre Dame was in the mix. So there was one less spot for a conference champ. That's not going to be the case this year. So if Baylor finishes as a 12-1 Power 5 champ, it's going to take something pretty extraordinary to keep them out, right?
But what you laid out is not extraordinary. That's not extraordinary at all. I mean, you're telling me that an Alabama team without Tua, without a win over a top 15 team, because if they beat Auburn, Auburn's not going to be a top 15 team at that point.
Right.
I mean, right now, Auburn's not even a top 15 team in either poll, and they haven't even, and they're a 3-loss team. If they lose, they're probably going to fall into the 20s. That would be their best win.
As we know, the committee.
That would be their only win over a top 25 team also. One win.
Yeah, I think Baylor is the only team we're talking about in this whole situation where there would even be a possibility that about as a 12-1 champ.
By the way, Stu, also, just on where Baylor is in the rankings right now. So Baylor is, and again, this we're talking about polls, but until the the CFP comes out, we have to go off of a little of the games that have happened. So Baylor's 10-11. There are teams that are going to end up playing each other and losing in front of them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I get it. They're not going to get a push off of Kansas. They may get a little bit of a, I don't know if they'll get any boost off of blowing out Texas, but I still think that if the committee sees them beat a Oklahoma team that would probably be 5 at that point or 6, I think that might be enough for them to leapfrog an Alabama team that doesn't have a resume.
I guess the question is that I haven't really thought about is, if okay, all this talk about Mac Jones against Auburn. If Alabama wins, but it's like 13-10, 14-9, is it possible a committee would then drop Alabama, even with a win, drop them and say, yeah, we don't think they're one of the 5 best teams without Tua?
I don't know. I don't know if they would do that, but I mean, there's really nobody else that has much of an argument. I mean, at this point, you know, I don't look at anybody else and say, okay, well, there's another one loss team that's hanging out there. I guess at that point you start getting into 10-2 Florida.
You have completely ignored a possible 12-1 team. The Gophers. The Gophers are sitting there at 9-1.
Well, they are now, but I'm assuming that they would lose. If they're going to have to, they're going to be a 2-loss team, though.
Well, not if they win the Big Ten.
Well, then they're going in. If they win the Big Ten, the Gophers are going in.
Well, if they win the Big Ten, both the Gophers and Ohio State are going in. So,
yeah, no, you're right. That's a scenario. Yeah, if the Gophers go, then I don't know what would happen then.
There's a lot of moving parts here. We don't know if the SEC or the Big Ten are going to have 2 legit contenders at the end because of a conference championship upset.
Let's say, for making it easier, that LSU beats Georgia. Mm-hmm. So no Georgia, it's LSU. Clemson's there. And then we're talking about what? I guess with them, then there'd be 2 Big Ten teams, right? Sorry, Utah.
Yeah, because we're talking about Minnesota has to go beat Wisconsin this week, who was number 12 in the playoff rankings.
And they have a win over Penn State.
They already have a win over Penn State, who's going to finish 10-2. And now you're talking about going into the championship game and beating an Ohio State team that has been arguably the most impressive team in the country all season. Obviously, we don't know what's going to happen against Michigan, but I think they're going to win. That would be the ultimate closing argument. Yes, the Minnesota Gophers would make the playoff. I feel much more confident in saying that than I do Baylor, because Baylor beating Oklahoma is just not going to get the same kind of bump that Minnesota beating Ohio State would. Undefeated Ohio State.
Yeah, it's that would be an interesting scenario, the Minnesota one of all of them. I mean, I don't think you could leave them out.
You couldn't. Now, this is going to require them doing something. Matt Brown, our editor and just history extraordinaire, pointed out that when they beat Penn State, it was the first time since 1962 that they had won a game at home where both teams were ranked. So now they got to go do it this week for the second time since 1962. And then they have to follow that up by knocking off 12-0 Ohio State. It's probably... You love playing the game. Give me your percentage chance that Minnesota is going to win these next 2 games. Both of them.
13%.
Yeah, that's probably around where I would say.
I mean, that actually. 20%.
That's probably too high. I might say 9%.
I give them like a 40%. Yeah, I'm guessing it might be probably around 5% realistically. Because I think just to beat Wisconsin, I think it's under 40%. And then I think, no, you know what? I'm going to say it's a 50-50 there. But I don't like their chances against Ohio State at all.
I think that would be pretty ugly.
So I'm going to revise Ohio State and say 4%.
We've now seen Ohio State handle both Wisconsin and Penn State. Now, Minnesota beat Penn State. If you want to make the case that Minnesota would give Ohio State a tougher test than Penn State, okay. But they're just crushing these people. And I don't think that Minnesota is a big step up from those two, if at all. So I think the tougher game might be for Ohio State might be this week at Michigan. Michigan has obviously looked a lot better over the last five games, especially on offense. Still a double-digit favorite, though, in Ann Arbor. Obviously haven't lost to them since 2011. And it was interesting after the game. This is how much the sport has... it's interesting that what am I trying to say here? As we know, the playoff just dominates everything else this time of year. I actually intentionally led Forward Pass with a non-playoff related topic this week because I feel like I've been writing about like the same five or six teams, Ohio State, Alabama, LSU, for a long time now. So with that in mind, Ohio State wins that game, clinches the Big Ten East. Are they going to move up to number one? That's the national story. But I got to tell you, most of the questions I got after the game from the local reporters was about Michigan. And they played right along. Like, they're totally locked in on the team up north, 365 days a year, et cetera, et cetera. So if you think there's any possibility that they're going to be like, well, we already locked up our spot in Indy, so we can take it easy this week, no. Like, that's how much the Michigan game matters to Ohio State. Obviously, it matters a lot to Michigan, too. But yeah, I'm having trouble seeing how the Wolverines pull that off.
Shocked that Greg Schiano is not the Rutgers head coach after all this?
I'm not shocked that Greg Schiano is not the Rutgers coach, because the longer it dragged on with these negotiations, the longer you... I mean, I remember at one point, I don't forget if it was you or somebody else saying, like, their hope was to be able to announce him that Friday before the Ohio State game. You know, some positivity before they went and got their butts kicked. And, you know, so the longer it dragged on, it seemed like it's going to be harder for this to happen. But, man, Sunday was really something to watch the two parties try to control the media narrative. You have Steve Politi wrote just a he's a, you know, longtime columnist, NJ.com, authority in that scene, just killing Rutgers for, like, that they shouldn't even be in the Big Ten if they're not willing to meet. If they're not willing to do what it takes to get Greg Schiano and meet his quote unquote demands, which, hey, the 8-year contract, that's a pretty big ask in 2019. But the salary was on par. You know, $4 million a year would be right on par in the Big Ten. Apparently, one of the demands was use of a private plane for recruiting, which, as you know, is pretty much standard these days. So he was just killing Rutgers. But then there were anonymous quotes out there from people involved in the search, basically insinuating that this guy didn't really want to have the job that much. He was just using us to, you know, make one demand after another. Where are you on all this?
I'm surprised that it didn't get done. Right now, Rutgers needs to go a long ways if it wants to be resourced as a legitimate Big Ten program. At the end of it, I think. And it's going to be ironic to use this term because it brings Tennessee into this. But Greg Schiano, to a lot of people around the state of New Jersey, is their John Gruden. And he did a really good job there. And so the opportunity for him to come back seemed like it was a no-brainer. And it's not going to happen. And now you wonder what direction they go in. I'm interested to see. You know, I did a story that ran on The Athletic, just went up last night. A couple of the names that I think they will really look at are guys who are not sitting head coaches. And so you're like, well, wait, they just went and hired Chris Ash and it was a disaster. But if they go hire Jeff Hafley, who's now at Ohio State and is a defense coordinator there, or if you even hire Anthony Campanile, who's on the Michigan staff, both those guys have really strong ties in the state of New Jersey, and that's critical. Chris Ash didn't have any of that, and that really hurt him, and ultimately I think that worked against him. I'm very curious to see what direction they go. I think that at this point, they've got to move fast, and what's different now than it was a few years ago is there's an early signing period, and I think considering this job has been open since late September, that's problematic. And you know, Butch Jones is a guy that has interviewed for the job. And as I said in the column that on The Athletic, it was reported that Butch Jones had pulled out of the out of this surge. He did not. I'm told that report was actually inaccurate. But again, this is a tough job in a really tough division. It's a much tougher job than it was when Greg Schiano left it to go to the NFL. So, and now potentially to make it even more complicated is Boston College's job. Steve Adazio's seat has really gotten hot, and that's probably a more attractive job to a lot of people because it's in the ACC as opposed to in the smack dab in the Big Ten East. Now there's better recruiting talent in New Jersey than there is in the Boston area, but there's more of a history of being successful and competing at BC than there is at Rutgers. So things have gotten a lot more complicated just in the last few weeks on this front.
I think that it's not like Greg, and I realize like Tennessee fans in particular, but a lot of fans think like, why do you guys keep building up Greg Schiano? It's not that I think he's Vince Lombardi. It's just that he is the only guy in recent history that has demonstrated the ability to win at Rutgers. Granted, it was in the Big East and not the Big Ten. So there's really nobody else there's nothing there's nothing about Butch Jones that makes me think he could come in and turn Rutgers into a, you know, perennial bowl team in the Big Ten. There's nothing about any of those candidates, and it's not necessarily...
What about Brett Bielema?
Brett Bielema would be really interesting. That would be... I would like... First of all, I'd just like to have him back in college football, selfishly, because he's so fun to deal with. He's such a great personality. But you got to assume he would try to bring that Wisconsin system to Piscataway. And I guess the question is, would that work? I have no idea.
Yeah, what's interesting on that front is there's way more talent in New Jersey than there is where he won big at Wisconsin. I get it. Wisconsin was, and I guess when he was there, the divisions were different. But Wisconsin had more of a track record. He took over for Barry Alvarez, and the thing was rolling pretty good. So.
Yeah, the single biggest thing working against the next Rutgers coach is that they're in the Big Ten East. It just seems like they are doomed. They're going to be doomed for a long time to a lot of very lopsided losses to Michigan, Ohio State.
I would agree with that, but look, Tom Allen had Indiana in the top 25.
Yeah, that's true. And I guess if you can do it in Indiana, you can do it at Rutgers. So you mentioned Adazio. I mean, this coming weekend, like this Sunday after Thanksgiving is usually the Black Sunday in college football, and I do think Adazio is going to be on that list. Who else, what other places do you have a strong hunch are going to open probably as soon as next Sunday?
Yeah, I think whether it's Sunday or shortly thereafter, I think you'll see places like UNLV. I think you will see Old Dominion. I think I agree with you. I think Boston College is in trouble. I'm curious to see what might happen at Missouri with Barry Odom. Now, I think they're going to beat Arkansas to get bowl eligible, but I don't know how great the relationship is between he and the AD there. So that's definitely a question mark. I think one of the names that, as I mentioned in my story, to keep an eye on for the Rutgers job is the head coach at Mississippi State right now, Joe Moorhead. They have the Egg Bowl. Joe Moorhead did a terrific job as a coordinator in the Big Ten at Penn State. The fit so far in Starkville hasn't been great, and I think people have been underwhelmed by the expectations, and I think there's increasing pressure there. So if they finessed an exit there from Mississippi State and reset his clock at Rutgers, where he is a Northeast guy, that might make sense on a lot of fronts. So those are a couple of the jobs. The one that, and we talked about this a lot on the podcast last week, that's the biggest job out there, and it's also the most entangled, is what's happening at USC. I mean, from what I've been told, and I think we'll have a story on this on The Athletic in probably in a day or so, is just there's a lot of support from the new AD Mike Bone, as well as the new president Carol Folt, for Clay Helton. They're very comfortable with him. But there is going to be a lot of pushback from some influential USC people about, hey, we're done with Clay Helton. We like him as a guy. We just don't think he can really get it going here and get it done. And they're 8-4, and he actually did a good job getting him to 8-4, given all the injuries. Third string quarterback. Well, third string quarterback is actually better than any other quarterback to have in the program. I think they know he's more talented, but that's the one that could create some dominoes if USC does in fact open up.
There was a lot. It's a fascinating situation. First, we thought he was going to be gone last year. Lynn Swann, morning after the Notre Dame game, shocks everybody, says he's staying. Then everybody spent the whole past year assuming this is a done deal, foregone conclusion, Clay Helton will be gone. And certainly after they got crushed by USC, third loss at the time, or fourth loss at the time, you know, it just seemed inevitable. But I got to agree with you, there was a lot of Clay Helton love coming off of that UCLA game, including some interesting, read into it what you want, but there were some, a couple of the reporters, might even have been our guy, Antonio Morales, had video footage of Bone congratulating Clay after the game, telling him, you know, first of all, Clay telling him, pointing out to him, like, you're undefeated. They're 3-0 since Bone got the job. And Bone telling him, enjoy this, Clay, great job, blah, blah, blah. Did not look like the vibe of a guy who's thinking about firing him. Then you had a lot of, like, neutral national voices weighing in the day after and being like, you know, he actually did a pretty good job this year. I don't know what everybody's freaking out about. But I'm with you. If they do decide to keep him, there's going to be a mass mutiny among USC fans. They've been done with him for a year now.
Yeah, I think that this is going to be going to be a very interesting dynamic over the next couple of weeks.
One other hot seat job I wanted to mention, possibly. I haven't really heard it mentioned, but I feel like the Kevin Sumlin tenure at Arizona is just a doomed failure. They're going to have a losing season again. They've lost 6 in a row. He's now fired 3 of his defensive assistants in the last few weeks. This just, I have no confidence that he's going to turn Arizona around. Is there any possibility that's going to come down?
They would owe him a lot of money, and I don't think Arizona has a lot of money. So that's the part that is very sticky right now. I don't know. It's going to get really, really interesting. But I don't think they go in that direction just because I think his buyout is too much for them to get into.
Well, that's probably the case, but he's going to need to hit the reset button and come up with a plan for that program because this one is not working. I think it's been really sad to watch Khalil Tate go from Heisman candidate under Rich Rod he's basically part of a platoon that is just kind of riding out the string they got against Utah, and granted Utah's excellent. They had their lowest yardage in a game in 10 years. It's just a total mess. Two jobs that I don't think are coming open, but their coaches are definitely, actually I know they're not coming open, but their coaches are definitely feeling the heat right now. One is Texas, where it's been a pretty brutal third season for Tom Herman. They're now 6-5. And then I want to get into it didn't get much attention, but I cannot believe that Miami lost to FIU. Didn't just lose to FIU. We're getting crushed by FIU for most of that game. And Miami fans are not happy with Manny Diaz right now. Okay, things move fast on this podcast. Just to give the listeners a little insight into what just happened. We were talking about jobs that might come open. One of the ones Bruce mentioned was UNLV. Then suddenly he disappears on us and we have to stop recording for a few minutes. And bam, there goes the tweet from Bruce that Tony Sanchez, UNLV's coach, has just informed the team that he will not return. I got to be honest, I hadn't been following UNLV football very closely. Was this expected?
It was. He did some really good things there. And they have now pretty good facilities. They were not very well resourced before. But I guess they just didn't win enough. 3-8. And I think that's it's an interesting job. I think that, he was a high school coach. A lot of people liked him. Just didn't win enough there. It's just came back to that.
And that's been the case for one UNLV coach after another. They just can't seem to figure it out. And there has been some sense that with the new stadium opening, with the Raiders coming to town, the bowl games getting an upgrade, like there's a lot of enthusiasm for college football. Whoever the next coach is can ride the momentum of that. All right. Unfortunately, we got so caught up talking about so many things in college football that we ran out of time for the mailbag in this episode. We will come back later this week with the Audible Extra on the Athletic app, and we will get to your questions then, as well as preview some of the huge rivalry games this coming weekend. We'll see you next time. If you enjoy the Audible, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Leave us a review and a rating if you could, too. It helps us get the word out. Our producer is John Hayes. Our theme song is Dangerous by Kevin and the Octaves. You can download their music on Spotify or Apple Music. Follow me on Twitter at SL Mandel. Follow Bruce at Bruce Feldman CFB. And if you're not yet a subscriber to The Athletic, what are you waiting for? You can get 40% off an annual subscription by using this link, theathletic.com/theaudible. That's 40% off your subscription to The Athletic. We'll talk about it for years.
Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets, and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.